From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. When Abraham Lincoln ran for president, he didn't campaign on his own behalf. That was deemed unseemly in those days. Other speakers hit the hustings to tout the man from Springfield, Illinois. But in 1860, before he was nominated, Lincoln did speak publicly, and never more effectively than he did that February in New York City.
The facts with which I will deal this evening are mainly old and familiar, nor is there anything new in the general use I shall make of them. If there shall be any novelty, it will be in the mode of presenting the facts and the inferences and observations following that presentation.
This is actor Sam Waterston speaking last month at Cooper Union in New York, in the same auditorium where Lincoln addressed a crowd of New York Republicans that night.
What is the frame of government under which we live? The answer must be the Constitution of the United States. That Constitution consists of the original, framed in 1787, and under which the present government first went into operation, and 12 subsequently framed amendments. The first 10 of
this time, the room did not hiss with the sound of the gas jets that used to feed the chandeliers in Lincoln's day. But the speech was Lincoln's, the amplification was all in Waterston's vocal cords, and he held forth for well over an hour, just as Lincoln had. At Cooper Union, Abraham Lincoln accomplished a vital political mission. He convinced New York Republicans that he was a better candidate for president than New York's own Senator William Henry Seward, and that although he was a Westerner with no formal education, he was just as deft a speaker as any man in the East. The speech is the subject of Harold Holzer's book, Lincoln at Cooper Union.
His speech was predicated or inspired by a newspaper article that his lifetime rival Stephen A. Douglas had written a few months earlier, in which Douglas had claimed that the nation's founders had agreed that there was no authority vested in the federal government to arrest the spread of slavery ever. Lincoln believed that the founders hoped to put slavery on the course, as he put it, of ultimate extinction. By containing it, it would die a natural death. So Lincoln set out to do an enormous amount of research on our fathers, the fathers who had signed the Constitution, 39 of them. What had they done after the Constitutional Convention, which had so dexterously avoided the slavery issue? What had they done on subsequent votes on slavery? And Lincoln discovered, by his calculation, that 21 of the 39 people who had registered votes to give the federal government the authority to stop the spread of slavery.
He was making a lawyerly case, not that the people who signed the Constitution had said, I'm against slavery, but rather that they had in no way demonstrated that they were against the federal government's power to arrest the spread of slavery.
Yes, it called upon his courtroom abilities to dissect a point and pile up statistic after statistic, name after name, which the audience in New York found, if you look at the newspaper insertions for cheers and applause and laughter, they found it absolutely dazzling.
And on several occasions, he repeats Stephen Douglas's statement about our fathers having known better than us, quoting it time and again throughout the speech. It's a little bit reminiscent of Mark Antony and Julius Caesar and Brutus as an honorable man.
Yes. He is repeating the phrase over and over again, and one can only imagine, looking at those newspaper reports of the response, how he must have varied this phrase, our fathers, when they framed the government under which we live.
When they framed the government under which we live,
understood this question just as well and even better than we do now. He must have done it in seven or eight different varieties, mockingly.
Our fathers who framed the government under which we live,
tauntingly,
territories according to the practice of our fathers who framed the government under which we live,
dramatically, seriously,
that our fathers who framed the government under which we live, the men who made the Constitution, decided this same constitutional question in our favor long ago.
And the point of it was to show that he was accepting Stephen A. Douglas's premise, that the founders knew the situation better than we, so why not rely on what they believed, and I will now demonstrate that.
You observe that Abraham Lincoln 2 years earlier had invoked the famous phrase that a house divided against itself cannot stand. In that speech in 1858, his case against slavery was, with that phrase from the New Testament, from Mark, he was making a biblical argument. Now he was shifting his sources to a constitutional argument instead.
But very much keeping in mind that phrase, our fathers, who formed the government. Lincoln, in a sense, was replacing the father who had spoken of the house divided with the secular fathers, the people who had made the government. And it was an ingenious call upon emotion and reason at the same time.
Among the many things that Lincoln said at Cooper Union, one thing he did not say, and that might have been implicit in his speech 2 years earlier when he spoke about a house divided itself not being able to stand, one thing he didn't say was, I'm going to free the slaves and end slavery.
Well, to have done so would have placed him on the outer fringes of politics, not a viable candidate for any office in the United States, much less in Illinois, which had voted only 20 years earlier to bar free African Americans from the state. So we're talking about a deeply racist society, and Lincoln had been castigated by people for that house divided sentiment, and he had backed away from it during the Lincoln-Douglas debates. But Lincoln says at Cooper Union quite the opposite of house divided. He warns the South in the second part of his speech. You who would say that if a Republican is elected, would break up the Union, remember, it's not going to be tolerated. The House can't be divided, ever. That's freedom of choice. That's what one man, one vote is all about. And that's the freedom that we all support, regardless of section, or should support.
Let us be diverted by none of those sophistical contrivances wherewith we are so industriously plied and belabored. Contrivances such as groping for some middle ground between the right and the wrong. Vain as the search for a man who should be neither a living man nor a dead man. Such is a policy of don't care on a question about which all true men do care, such as union appeals beseeching true union men to yield to disunionists, reversing the divine rule and calling not the sinners but the righteous to repentance. Let us have faith that right makes might. And in that faith, let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it.
That's Sam Waterston's reading last month in New York City, which marked the launch of Harold Holzer's new book, Lincoln at Cooper Union.
There's more about Lincoln's Cooper Union address, including a link to the full text, at our website, npr.org.